Good morning, good morning. Back with you, David Walker here. Regular listeners will know that we've been discussing the state enterprise sector for several weeks. You know, and we've had some very powerful discussions. And I think now that most of us have a good understanding of, one, what comprises the state enterprise sector, you know, the history of it, how it started way back, as we were told by Tony Fraser, with ISCOT and other state enterprises of the era, seeking to kickstart other sectors of the economy other than the energy sector, and the fact that the state enterprise sector has mushroomed since then and has reached a size where we aren't even entirely sure as to how many enterprises there are in the sector, much less to know what is the performance of the sector, how many of them are in profit, how many of them are losing money, and what is the rationale for each of them. And the last one that we had in the series before today was where we discussed with Catherine Kumar of the Chamber of Commerce. And we had agreement, and I think it's an agreement that's shared by almost everybody who's participated, that we need more information. We need a better understanding of exactly what makes up the state enterprise sector and why particular enterprises are currently in the sector. So we've all been calling for this additional information. We would like to see a review that would begin by listing all the enterprises that the government tells us are in the sector and providing us with that analysis and information that we've been asking for. Now, my guest for today is not here as yet, so that although today we should have been concluding on this stuff, in the interim, while we're waiting, I want to begin the discussion which we are committed to having here, both on Forward Thinkers and at the radio station 104.7 on the upcoming budget. You will, of course, be hearing quite a great deal about the budget from various sources. So what we want to do here at 104.7 is to set it in a particular context. And that context really is within a framework that was established by none other than the Minister of Finance himself last year, which was his desire and his intention within a period of 5 years to reduce our annual deficit to zero. And for me, certainly, that is the more important context into which the budget for this year has to be placed. Because having said that he intended to reduce the deficit last year, he deferred all action for 12 months. So having been given 12 months grace, I would expect him to come to the table to give us some answers as to how we are going to reduce this deficit to zero within 5 years and why we should believe in his plans for so doing. I am pleased to say that our guest has arrived. Mr. Afra Raymond is here with us. Little introduction needed. So, good morning, Afra.
Hi, David. Good morning. Am I live on air?
You are live.
Good, good, good. Welcome, and thank you to 104.7 for having me as a guest once again. Today's topic is of great interest to myself and, of course, to the wider listenership. The whole question of state and the issues or state agencies and the issues that flow from that. And there's so many of them, it's difficult to know where to start. I mean, what ideas have you got to start, David?
Well, I was reminding listeners of the fact that we have discussed quite a lot of it over the past few weeks. Uh-huh. And so we'll try to avoid repeating what has been done. We've looked at the history of it, how it started, and it was suggested that the major initial push was ISCOT with the stated intention of kickstarting a sector other than the oil and gas sector, and that the government of the day found that the private sector was not stepping up to the plate, so that they took it upon themselves to do so. Mm-hmm. Having started the major thrust into the state enterprise sector that way, it mushroomed for reasons that didn't always have to do with the initial rationale, you know, having enterprises in the public sector.
Yes.
And we ended, well, we had the trade unions give their view and so on. And last week, we had Catherine Kumar of the Chamber of Commerce expressing what is one of my biggest concerns and reiterating that, which is the lack of information.
Yes.
Not just lack of information about the extent of the sector, but also reporting effectively on that sector. We don't know how many are in profit, how many are in loss, what is the drain on the public purse, etc. So with all of that out of the way, I know that there is one particular area that you wanted to discuss, but then we're free to go in any other direction. And that area that you had mentioned to me previously was a comparison with international best practice. You know, how do we stand by comparison with other countries?
Well, the interesting thing is the extent to which other countries have managed to rationalize or to reduce the number of state enterprises in those countries. So, for instance, one of the pieces of research we did recently was looking at a best practice environment in a country like New Zealand, yes, which is a small country. I think the population of New Zealand is just about 4 million people, and it's considered to be a developed country.
Yes.
And New Zealand, for that population of about 4 million people in a developed environment, socially and economically, has just a little over 20 state enterprises. Trinidad and Tobago, which is our country, we're all proud of it and so on, we have just about a million and a half people. And I think, and it's according to who you ask, some say it's 58 state enterprises, some say it's 72. It's over 50. Okay?
And Catherine, frankly, did give some research that her office did and came up with 72 direct or indirect.
That's why I said 72 and 58. Yes. And another document in the central bank will show you 58, yeah?
Yes.
And they're both current documents. So, in fact, even as an elementary question, David, as to how many, what is the number of state enterprises we have? Even those of us who try to study it, it's very difficult to settle on a number.
Yes.
Okay? But the point I'm making is that we have a vast number compared to some of the international countries that exhibit best practice in terms of how they manage public resources. Yeah. And also, we have the question that the number of state enterprises, quite frankly, appears to be escalating. And it appears that only when a government gets into an absolutely desperate situation and its back is to the wall, like what happened with the NIR government in the recession in 86, 87, 88, only when something like that unfolds will a political leadership class consider disposing of state assets, or more to the point, reducing its hold over public resources, put the thing in a or reduces its power base, to put the thing in a
broader context, because rubric, that is one of the issues that, again, I had raised with the budget last year, because I am strongly of the view that the government, as part of its policy, should be reducing its footprint in the economy.
You see, because there's an aspect of that, several narratives here. I would oscillate back and forth, David and listeners. I would oscillate back and forth between some observations that might be fresh, because I've tuned into one or two of your programs, and I may go back into some of the things that may have been covered by previous,
of course, we're
previous
relevant,
speakers,
yes,
and so on. We're relevant. But the point I wanted to make is that is the whole question of what are the state enterprises for? You see, this is really a very pertinent question. What are they for? Are they to A, and even if the whole existential question, why do they exist, is very perplexing. Do they A, exist to, as you said with Escott, go into areas of our economy that the private sector is not willing or able to go into at this point? Do they exist B, to supplement the social network? So in other words, you have organizations like the HDC that would build affordable housing that would partially satisfy the first objective. Do they to create employment opportunities or entrepreneurship opportunities for the wider growth of the society? Do they exist maybe to give competition? Because some of the state enterprises, and one current topical example is First Citizens Bank, some of the state enterprises, quite frankly, do not, In the strict definition of the term, do not conduct a public purpose. Nonetheless, they are large, they are state-owned, they are flourishing, and one of the points of view that I have had for some time is perhaps some of those organizations that exist in that part of the arena should perhaps offer a competitive challenge to maybe some of the existing players in that arena to be able to create some better options for consumers and so on. But this is one of the basic existential questions. What are they there for? And because we don't have a clarity, and as far as I'm concerned, former Minister Fernandez's first budget gave an attempt, it's about two or three pages long in that budget, to try to grapple and to try to speak about his efforts to grapple with the whole riddle about state enterprises.
Yes.
And what were they there for, and how big were they, and how could we manage it, and how could we stop some of the errors of the past, and so on. And in pursuance of that, under Ducaran's administration, the Ministry of Finance published a revised performance manual for state enterprises, which in fact was three times longer than the previous one. The previous one was 2008, and in 2011, Ducaran and them published one that is about three times longer, with a lot more rules, and the rules appear to be a lot stricter. And we need now to put that to the test. Have those improved standards been adhered to? Have we had, as the public, as the taxpayers, as the citizens of the Republic, have we had a better performance? Do we get more for our dollar? And this is the kind of lack of information, which is a subject that is close to my heart. And also, as you mentioned, David, is something that Catherine Kumar from the Chamber of Commerce mentioned in her presentation here last week.
Yeah.
You know, it's a critical concern, because we're not going to know whether we're performing if we don't know who's doing what. How long did it take them? What did it cost them? What lessons have been learned? Sometimes things go wrong. What lessons are learned? You know?
Yeah. You may also have heard in the episode that we had with Conrad Enel.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for having him on was that he had specific line responsibility.
Of course he did, yes.
For, well, I then found that it was not all state enterprises. So there isn't one minister who has line responsibility.
Himself and Sahade shared the portfolio, yes. Christine Sahade was the other minister.
Yes, but there is also the situation where some state enterprises fall under even another ministry because of the particular public function that they discharge.
Well, finish your point about Conrad. I'll come back to you on that point. That's an interesting point.
Yes, so that, for example, HCC, would fall under the housing minister to some extent. While also falling under the Minister of Finance.
Yeah.
So there is a governance structure issue.
Right, but the point I wanted to come to, when I said I would come back to you on a point, was this. There are two limbs to the whole question about how the state enterprises are governed. And I'm just making a broad discussion here. First of all, the level of ownership and what you might want to call control, because the owners of a company are its shareholders.
Yes.
And the shareholders have control, and they can appoint and remove people from the board of directors and so on and so forth. Okay, someone on an extraordinary meeting and so on and so on. The shareholder of state enterprises is the Minister of Finance through Corporation Sole, which is the NL role that you are speaking to.
Yes.
At the same time, the second limb of the discussion, which is the more operational limb, is the fact that a state enterprise may be set up, and most of them ape the needs of a particular ministry. They're what you might want to call an implementing agency.
Yes.
So in the case of education, we have the EFCL, Education Facilities Company Limited, and their only client is the Ministry of Education.
Yes.
You have MTS, which have clients across the whole public sector, to security and maintenance. And we have HDC, and their only client is the Ministry of Housing.
MTS is a particularly interesting example from my experience.
Very interesting. But the point I'm making is that with NL and Sahadeo in the Ministry of Finance, there were, and not only with them, it's a continuing issue, there are some state enterprises which sit within finance with both limbs, and FCB is an example.
Yes.
So the line ministry to which FCB would have responded would be coming through finance, because it's a financial agency, you see. But generally speaking, there's this question where agencies are owned by the Ministry of Finance, but in fact control and receive their instructions from what is called, what in Trinidad and Tobago parlance, we call them the line ministry.
Line ministry.
And some of that became visible with the sort of imbroglio and confusion around Caribbean Airlines.
When we had
a chairman who appeared to be resisting the line minister, and then we had another board was appointed, and the Minister of Finance dismissed that board, but it seems that those people for not performing the proper standard and so, and it seems that those people enjoyed some degree of political favor because they were soon reappointed to a bigger board.
Absolutely.
So we have this sort of unseemly is a kind of polite word for it, but we have this sort of unseemly rotation, like a playground. where we just go wrong and wrong, and we don't really seem to be changing much apart from the angle of things.
And
we need to deal with some of these issues, the governance issues, and how is the taxpayers' money being spent? How are the taxpayers' tasks? It's in health, whether it's in housing, whether it's in education, and the state agencies have a critical role to play in that. And I mentioned, when I mentioned earlier on, David, the existential question as to why do they exist, I mentioned that not just to make sport, but to come back to one of the key things that we seldom discuss it, but the whole question of the state enterprises being created to create employment. I touched on that, and that's a big part of the kind of the thing that drives them and gives them a power. That is often most people, we don't talk or write much about it. But those jobs are prize jobs in there. You know, they're better paid than the civil service, and so on and so on.
It's not, well, it's jobs at two levels, I guess. It's jobs for the boys and girls, but it's also jobs for those who our rulers wish to see employed under a certain amount of freedom.
Yes.
They can enjoy. Within the public sector.
Yes.
So that the real function of the organization sometimes becomes the second or third priority within the list of priorities as to how the organization is managed, which is why it's so important that we have the effective reporting. You know, and I wonder sometimes whether there is something that we as a public could do. You know, a lot is falling back on us to become now the gatekeepers within the system. And maybe we need to start building reporting mechanisms ourselves, you know, make use of modern technology.
That question about us becoming the gatekeepers of our own society is no bad thing, because we really have a kind of a substantive failure. We have where these real substantial issues are concerned, we have very limited debate, David, in the parliament. We have very limited debate from the political parties. In fact, one thing we can say for sure, and we can speak about all the political parties out there, one thing you can say for sure, we're not going to get a substantive debate and substantive ideas about how to deal with any of these problems from any of them. All we get is sport, sport, and sport. It's like the olden days when the savannah used to be a haven for horse racing.
Yes.
People are just jockeying for position. We have thoroughbreds and we have fillies and we have all kinds of animals out there, and we're betting on this horse and we're betting on that horse and long odds, and they have dew on the grass and a lot of nonsense. We have real things to discuss, and we're not going to get that from the political
and the judgment that you refer to is one of them.
The judgment, we have to discuss that, because there was a judgment by the appeal court on the important question of what constitutes a state-controlled enterprise.
Right, so it fits in perfectly with the discussion that we're having.
Absolutely, because one of the concerns we have is that state enterprises ought to conform to that mechanism that allows us to know what's happening in them. Yes. And one of the provisions of the Integrity in Public Life Act, and in the ninth category of person in the third schedule of the Integrity in Public Life Act, is in fact directors of state-controlled companies or companies in which the state has a controlling interest.
Yes.
And I had taken that in several of my applications to mean that people like directors of HDC or CAL or First Citizens Bank, to name a few, as well as directors of CL Financial, because the government had the power under the shareholders agreement to name most of the directors, that people like that were public officials, and therefore they were obliged to complete their declarations in conformity with the Integrity Commission's requirements. But what the appeal court found, there was a case where they gave a judgment on the 27th of June, and that day, and that case is number 30 of 2008. And in that case, TSTT had gone to court to get a declaration from the court as to whether the Integrity in Public Life Act applied to their directors. And the case that TSTT was making an outline was that, in fact, it's 51% owned by the state, and some of its directors are foreign, and they wanted, basically, to cut a long story short, they wanted to be free of the Integrity in Public Life requirements. And that case was decided, I think it was 2005, by Justice Judith Jones. She actually, it was a 2005 lawsuit, and she decided in 2008 that, in fact, that phrase I just recited, directors of state control companies, which or companies in which the state has a controlling interest, that refers to TSTT, and they have to fill out the forms. Yeah. They immediately went to appeal, and the appeal took 3 years, which is why it was filed in 2008, and the judgment was just given in the last hearing was in 2010. The judgment was just given in the 27th of June, and that judgment, as far as I'm concerned, it does grave damage to our country's integrity and oversight provisions, because the meaning of that judgment, and I'm going to summarize down to one sentence of what Justice Gregory Smith said in his judgment. It was an appeal court judgment. There was also the Chief Justice, Mr. Ivor Archie, and there was Mr. Alan Mendonca, who agreed fully with Smith's judgment. But the key phrase for me in the judgment is Smith saying that the court finds, I think it's a penultimate sentence, that this act, the Integrity Act, applies to state corporations, state enterprises, where the state has a controlling interest, the state owns most of the shares, the state can appoint most of the directors, and discharges a public purpose.
Yes.
Which, of course, raises the pregnant question. And this is why we have to be so careful. I don't know what they were thinking when they composed that judgment. I read it several times. It's 20 pages long. But it raises the important question, but what is a public purpose? Because if it is the considered judgment of the appeal court in this country that a public purpose, it is essential to demonstrate that a state enterprise performs a public purpose before there develops a requirement to fulfill the Integrity in Public Life Act, what then is the case with Caribbean Airlines? Because it's my view that Caribbean Airlines doesn't fulfill a public purpose. Neither does First Citizens Bank.
Correct.
And if you wanted to get thorough with it, and you wanted to define a public purpose as a purpose or an activity that in fact the private sector debated. Okay, and therefore it is required that a public entity performs that function. You would find that a great many state enterprises do not perform a public purpose. They may perform a particular act or a series of acts on behalf of the public, but that doesn't make it a public purpose, because First Citizens Bank, the same exact acts that First Citizens Bank performs and services that they offer, those acts and those services are performed by Royal Bank and Scotia Bank and Intercommercial Bank and other banks.
Yes.
So where's the public purpose?
Yeah.
And if this judgment stands, and I hope it does not, let me put that into the media, I hope it does not, I hope that the powers that be, the Attorney General or whosoever, the Law Association, the Transparency Institute, I hope that the organizations that have a concern for the broad public interest in the country, some of them are public organizations, some of them are NGOs and civil society organizations, could take up this call. That judgment needs to be re-examined. It does severe damage to our limited network of entitlements to get information about what's happening in our public agencies, because it would mean that Caribbean Airlines directors don't have to fill out a form. It would mean that First Citizens directors don't have to fill out a form. And it certainly means that TSCT's directors don't have to fill out a form.
Well,
and you really have to stop and wonder, well, could that result... And David, before I finish, I'm going to stop after this next little sentence. Could that result be what the appeal court meant to achieve? Because I want to say, because in my opinion, in my respectful opinion, that result, which is the result of what they've done, the appeal court in number 30 of 2008, that result is a tremendous detriment to our national interest, our public interest. And the other point I want to make for listeners to be aware of it is that in addition to TSCT bringing the lawsuit to try to get a legal declaration that it didn't have to conform to the Integrity in Public Life Act, the Integrity Commission themselves, in that appeal, were also bringing a motion to limit the number of companies for which they have oversight.
Yes.
So, in fact, there are two aspects of it, and paradoxically, we had a judgment which satisfied both sides. So, in fact, it's an imperfect judgment, but it's a perfect solution, because neither side has anything to appeal on. They both got what they wanted. So in fact, it's a little bit of a fix for the public. And it's the sort of thing that only a mastermind could have crafted. I shake my head. It's not grudging admiration. It's something else. But I do shake my head when I look at number 30 of 2008.
Yes. Well, you know, I have a narrow In addition to the broad perspective, I also have a narrow perspective relative to the CLECO CL financial issue.
Yes.
Because I have been adamant all along. I have submitted freedom of information requests, as you are aware, that are pending. And I am concerned now that because of this, that those freedom of information requests will simply be ignored.
Well, they will thwart you. They're probably going to try to thwart me too.
Well, precisely. The net effect of that, again, you taking the broader perspective, is that there is absolutely no means of finding out how $20 billion of public money is being spent.
$24 billion.
Having been given to a private company, which is what they're now saying that it is.
Yes,
it's still a private company. Yeah, yeah. So we are being told that $24 billion handed of our money to a private company, and we are not allowed to ask anything of the directors. We aren't even, well, you know, we always had a problem with, because of the Central Bank Amendment Act, that we couldn't ask questions of the company anyway.
Yes.
So the one little light at the end of the tunnel, the one avenue of possibility for us, was the Freedom of Information Act. And now, because of this judgment, we're being told, on behalf of all taxpayers, that you are not allowed to find out anything about either the people who are spending this money or how this money has been spent. I think we need to ask the people in Parliament, actually. And that's the second point I was going to raise. Yes, I would like to see an appeal. But bear in mind that part of this judgment said that effectively that the judges had decided that they did not believe that the intention of Parliament was X, and they therefore used a certain amount of latitude to interpret what they perceived the intention of Parliament to be. The simple solution to this would be Parliament to say, here is what we meant.
Well, that part of the judgment to be very difficult to understand. Choosing my words carefully, very difficult to understand. I mean, why would there be an act where they specifically added the end piece? They said state-controlled enterprises.
Yes.
They could have stopped there. But they went further. They said including enterprises in which the state has a controlling interest.
Yes.
Why would they have
bent over backwards
to come up with a different... Why would they have made an additional phrase?
Yes.
And we're finding that phrase wasn't included. So we have a real issue here in that... And let me just... let me try to locate this again, David, to give the broader context. We have a real issue here of oversight. We are witnessing, let's put this in a global context and bring it back down to where we are in the studio here at the corner of Paul Carew Street and Traverse Road. We are witnessing a global information war. The NSA, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, all of those things,
Bradley Manning,
all of those things are part of a global information war. Okay? Because we are now at a stage that you might want to describe as a social singularity. To borrow something from physics and science fiction, we are now at a stage of social singularity in terms of the ease with which, if we choose to, we can communicate with each other.
Yeah.
Okay, human consciousness and an understanding of how things are going have taken us inexorably, technology have taken us inexorably into that place. Therefore, it is now fundamental that the atmosphere be filled up with chaff and with stuff. And a lot of stuff is creative and new stuff and different entities and so on. But fundamental information has been purposely cut out of the picture. Therefore, speaking here to colleagues who are media workers, intellectual workers, colleagues who are in the arts, particularly the artists and the cultural workers, there's a particular responsibility at this time. Because of the rapidity of the technology, because of the shortage of real information, and because of the critical situation on the planet. It's not just in Trinidad and Tobago experiencing these things, you know. A critical situation on the planet, that we get to the point where we communicate better and better with each other. This is not an appeal for us to get together and sing Kumbaya. Okay, but we do need to join hands and delve a little deeper into what some of these issues are, because we need to have united action on some of these issues. The point is that coming to Trinidad and Tobago, we now have a stage, as David, you were outlining, we have a stage where the central bank, always exempt, from the Freedom of Information Act. And of course, I'm returning to the CL financial bailout. It's the biggest, I'm going to say it plainly, the biggest financial crime in the last 100 years in this region. I don't want to hear about no fire truck. I don't want to hear about no flag. $24 billion is $3.72 billion US dollars of our money that was spent, and I want to know who got it. I want to know the circumstances they got it in, and I think the public has a right to know. Let me go further. So the central bank is exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. The 2011 law that they passed in September 2011, September the 15th, it was signed into law in this country, cloaked the central bank with an additional exemption. So in fact, they became immune from any lawsuits arising out of their handling of the CLECO matter, which is what you were referring to, David.
Yes.
The only channel open to us, apart from burning tires and getting permission to my channel open to us, was to make a Freedom of Information application against the Ministry of Finance. And for those of you who are interested, you can go to my blog, afroraymond.com. My latest piece there is called Ministry of Finance Dance, okay, in which I describe a little inelegant dance, like somebody with two left feet. That's what it is, or a dwen with a foot pointing behind. A two left foot kind of dance to deal with the fundamental question. And here the question. Let me give you the question. So on the one hand, the Ministry of Finance is telling us, as David has says, that they've given $24 billion of our money to the largest private conglomerate in the Caribbean that ever existed in the Caribbean. And that in fact that process is called a bailout process, is coming to an end, and it's coming to an end smoothly. And in fact, all of the taxpayers' money is going to be repaid. And so in fact, we're being told that it was a difficult journey, but we're coming to the end smoothly, and the captains and the chiefs have managed the process in our interest, in the public interest. But on the other hand, when an individual like myself takes a lawsuit against the Ministry of Finance to get the particular information independently corroborated, I don't want to hear what Mr. Hawaii or Mr. Ducoran or Mr. Mariano Brown says. I want to hear what an independent corroborating agency says. We call that audited accounts. I want the details of who got money. When I take the legal action to put them into court, they hire a high-powered legal team headed by Russell Martineau, senior counsel, a five-person team. I understand that the next hearing they're going to have two more lawyers. And that team is strongly opposing my application and was able to say to the judge, Martino was able to say to the judge on the 23rd of May, that he's compromising, he's not going to give me any information, he's fighting me all the way. Now, what about those two things? It doesn't make sense. On the one hand, you've done very well, you've closed off these difficult negotiations, and the country's interest has been preserved. And on the other hand, you're absolutely refusing to publish any information. Now, listeners, be aware. Listen up. This is what's happening in our country. This is what's happening in our country. I started off speaking about Bradley Manning and Julian Assange and NSA. We know about the blimp and the spies and Reshmi and so on in our country. Everybody, every country has it. Be aware. All the information channels are being closed down and controlled. We have to get conscious. We have to hold a conscious meditation in this time. We have to hold a conscious meditation in this time about what's happening in our country. Because if Trinidad and Tobago does well, if Trinidad and Tobago performs well, we provide a proper example for the region. If Trinidad and Tobago does not do well and we go down in further confusion and bubble, it is bad for the entire region. Trinidad and Tobago has a particular leadership responsibility in this region of Caribbean people, Indian and African diasporas. We have a particular responsibility. So join in. Please join in and help us when you can.
I want to summarize for people,
sure,
exactly the way I see, mm-hmm, that this has developed.
Yes.
And I'll try to keep it as concise and as tight as possible.
Mm-hmm.
We have a situation here,
mm-hmm,
where on a specific issue,
yeah,
the government has spent, they tell us, $24 billion.
Yeah.
We have had no information as to who are the people who have been given the responsibility for disbursing that money. We know of two or three of the individuals, but beyond that, we don't know.
No, we don't.
Criteria were applied in selecting those people.
No.
there were no tenders, there were no invitations to apply for the positions, and so on. Right. So any information at all is lacking. We have been given no reports as to how that money has been spent, save and apart for some from some very simplistic even reporting, which you could drive a coach and horses through, and we will do,
which we have done many times.
Right. We then ask for further information that would be in the public domain in any other jurisdiction. And lo and behold, the government then decides it is going to spend more of our money.
Yes.
To stop us, whose money it is in the first place.
To fight me down,
To find out how it's been spent.
That's what's going on here.
It is a remarkable story. I relate it occasionally to former colleagues.
Of course.
And they simply cannot believe what's happening. Mm. They cannot believe also that the nation is so complacent about what is happening. They just do not understand why the gatekeepers, the institutions, the professionals, etc., aren't up in arms.
Okay. Let me say that is that aspect represents. There are two sides of that aspect, David. To answer you on a question about the whole relative quiet of the country around the CL financial issue. On the one hand, we have the question of what I have labeled a sort of civilizational crisis, where we have an issue of this size, and by and large, the educated people, the good people, the people who should know better, have very largely been quiet. And if anybody asks me anything, they will ask me, well, what you really doing that for? And what you fighting up with that for? And the trend of the conversation seems to be to try to establish what is really wrong with me. And my buff back to them is always, no, the question is, what is wrong with you? How could all of this happen? And you haven't said anything. You have not even written a letter to the editor. You haven't said anything. You haven't done anything. Do you belong to a club, a rotary club, a lodge? Do you belong to some organization? Are you prepared to act when you see wrong? Or is that just something in a movie? Or a book you read about Nelson Mandela, where is that coming from? We have to have a sense of right and wrong. But the other aspect of it, which is seldom discussed, and I want to thank Dr. Lester Henry from UWE, who had done some research, and Lester appeared on a panel with myself in June of 2011, a panel organized by UWE's Caribbean Center for Monetary Studies. It was the BBF, is a biennial conference, Banking, Business and Finance, number 4.
Yeah.
And Lester and I appeared on a panel together. And Lester gave a beautiful presentation. It hasn't received much coverage in the media. I mentioned it once or twice, but he gave a beautiful presentation where he attempted to give a context to the whole question of CL Financial having become literally too big to fail. And I think Mariana Brown mentioned it at the debate they had around the time the bailout was being discussed in early February of 2009, when in fact he was mentioning that I think about 56 or 55% of the country's insurance was held by Clico. And I think at the time that the company went down, of all of the premiums that are paid in the country for life insurance and pensions, I think Clico was between 55 and 60% is what they were getting. Now, that kind of thing is controlled in the advanced economies by something that they call antitrust rules and regulations and laws. And that came up in the 19th century, trying to battle a certain development in the American economy called robber barons, people who control all the steel and all the railways and all the coal and so on and so on. And our economy is simply not, we have not started to have that conversation. Henry has done the fundamental work as far as the CL financial question is concerned. He's done the fundamental work. And I think that's another thing we need to advance in terms of public debate and certainly discussion within the parliament, because if it is, we're talking about a financial crisis that took place, and it certainly was one, and we're talking about a resolution, and I don't know if there is a resolution, but one is certainly being promoted at the moment, I think we need to be discussing what are the differences in terms of rules, regulations and laws now, as thing in 07 and 08 and 09. What is there in place now to prevent that same stuff happening again. And for my own piece, to finish off on this one, David, my own piece, I would want to see a strong component of antitrust, where in fact it could never get possible again for one company to get to that size, that in fact if they creak, everybody has to run to prop them up. And in fact we have a relatively flexible system with a greater number of players. That is some of the concerns. But Dr. Lester Henry from UWE had done some work that was very interesting and very important work on this question.
Well, I feel strongly that we really haven't examined, you know, all the issues surrounding CLECO and CL Financial, and we certainly have not done enough to ensure that we don't have a recurrence, because the fundamental failings, which were identified by the governor at the time, he said, you know, interlocking directorships and related party transactions, he identified those as the fundamental failings. They have been continued under the stewardship of the very central bank. So how are we to have confidence that, in fact, I view the position now as even more dangerous than it was then, because the central bank simply does not function as the regulator anymore. How could you when you are running one of the enterprises within the sector? So we have no regulator.
Yes.
We previously had a poor regulator. Now we have no regulator.
Yeah, yeah.
So how could we be in a better position today?
No, it's a bad position.
You know, I don't want to totally dominate the discussion with CLECO and CL Financial, but we really do need to have that debate at some time in the future, because there are so many issues.
I'd be happy to be
aware of the one that I have been hammering away from the beginning, the notion that the regulator runs the company that it's supposed to be regulating. To me, that's where all our problems started with the rescue.
Himself to himself.
Yes.
I bet that is spoiler calypso. But I mean, David, coming back to the thing about state enterprises, and of course, CL Financial entered the discussion.
Yes.
Because at this moment in time, in my view, and given the sort of submissions that I put into the Integrity Commission and certain things I've written, in my view, CL Financial certainly is a state-controlled enterprise.
Concur.
Because the government appoints most of the directors. I think, according to the shareholders' agreement, the board shall comprise 7 people, and the government shall appoint 4. And then in addition to that, $24 billion of our money has gone in.
If that does not make it a state enterprise, what is?
It's gotten more money than that, so it's tantamount to being one. But coming back to the topic and turning a little bit to the construction-related state enterprises, we have a situation where we had a scenario under Patrick Manning with the construction of those buildings with Mr. Kolahat and Udicott and so on. We had a scenario where, in fact, what I identified was a situation where the state was actually crowding out private investment. So we had a vast number of first-class buildings being constructed in our capital city at great expense to the public purse. A lot of corruption and allegations of corruption that was ventilated thoroughly in the off inquiry from 2008 to 2010, and that is available online and so GCC's website, my website, and so on.
Let me just interject.
Sure.
We got a question earlier as to whether the report of the Point 14, the DB intersection, whether that report is available online.
It's on our website.
Okay, good.
It is available if you just go to the GCC's website on the homepage, www.jcc.org.tt. Okay. And on the front page, the homepage, the second item down on the right hand side, if you click there, you get all of the documents for the Point 14 highway matter. So you could, including the report of the HRC Highway Review Committee.
Okay, great.
So that's available. Yeah. But the point I was making is that we have a scenario where the state enterprises are supposed to be conducting themselves in a manner that is either doing things that the private sector won't do.
Yes.
Or creating employment opportunities or meeting social needs that the private sector won't do. One of the existential questions at the beginning of this interview, I started speaking about the need to interrogate the whole thing existentially. Why do they exist? One of the existential questions really is, why do they exist? And are we saying, with respect to Udicott and the Patrick Manning exercise, I'm calling it the Patrick Manning exercise, are we saying that Udicott existed to give competition to private landlords. Let us put the thing plainly. Landlords. Yes. People who own office buildings in Port of Spain. Because Manning said so several times, and I'm putting it forward for discussion. Are we saying that that was the purpose? That the purpose was, in fact, to bring to an end the situation where the government paid rents month after month to a particular group of landlords, and, in fact, to create a situation where the government owned its own property and didn't have to pay rents? That seems a fundamental rationale.
I do remember
Manning's exercise, okay? And some of those objectives are political, and some of them could be financial. And objectively, you look at them and ask yourself, is there really a case ever to be made that, in fact, an objective could be so important that money doesn't matter? To turn Eric Williams saying on his head, money is no problem. Yeah. Are we now at a stage of our national development or our national degeneration that, in fact, money is the problem? Because what seems to have happened in relation to that exercise in downtown Port of Spain, David and listeners, is that, in fact, we had a vast number of offices constructed at public expense, and that vast number of offices, when they're all completed and when they're all put on the market, which I expect will all happen within 12 months, when that happens, we are going to have a tremendous shift in the Port of Spain office market. Let me give an example of what I'm speaking about. Before Manning started his exercise, the last big high quality office building in Port of Spain that was constructed before the Patrick Manning / Call the Heart boom, the last big one was Nicholas Tower, which is the elliptical blue glass one down at Independence Square. Nicholas Tower contains 100,000 square feet of offices. It took Issa Nicholas 5 years to fill the building. 5 years. Now, what the Patrick Manning and Koala Hart exercise left this country with, what we paid for, was 2.3 million square feet. We built 23 Nicholas Towers. Everybody, every man, woman, and child have built 23 Nicholas Towers in this capital. We increased the supply of offices in the capital by about 35 to 40%. In the space of 3 to 4 years. It was literally a boom. A boom is normally followed by a crash, eh? But both metaphorically and literally, but really and truly, we are seeing a situation when all those offices are finished and they're ready for occupation, because Unicode recently gave out contracts for the fitting out of the buildings. When that is finished, we are going to have an issue in terms of rental levels and the capital city coming down. And I want to make the point in terms of the state enterprises being used as exemplars of best practice. And Unicode's website is a model of that. Mr. Manning always praised them, and he held them in high esteem, and he said it was the best performing state enterprise. Koala Hart was his best lieutenant, and so on and so on. If you go onto their website, watering. The sort of adherence to professional values and the highest quality of this and commercial values of that and so on and so on. And in fact, it's often discussed that the best project is the International Waterfront Project.
Mm-hmm.
And that project is a duck. It doesn't make any money. It can't. Okay, I've demonstrated it over and over. It can't make any money. The break-even rent for those offices would be, it's that of that complex comprises 885,000 square feet of offices. There's nearly 9 Nicholas Towers in that one complex.
Yeah.
Okay? The break-even rent, the rent they would need to earn to pay back the bank, is about $35 a square foot. And the most they could earn is $15 to $20 a square foot. We are never, ever going to break even at the International Waterfront Center. And if the best project that you ever did didn't make any money, as you say in Trinidad and Tobago, you're boss on your average. So you can't come and tell me about anything. And that is why, the moment they started building the International Waterfront Center, Unicode stopped publishing accounts. And up to now, they still haven't published any.
In spite of all the reports and the recommendations.
Yeah, reports and recommendations. New management, new chairman, new CEO, new everything. Same old thing. Okay? And when they could publish their accounts and explain how the flagship project is losing money, every month on month on month on month on month, for all those months. And if the best one is losing money, you're busting your average, to put it colloquially.
And this is where we need reporting into the entire
sector.
State sector.
Yes,
state-owned sector. We need a fairly straightforward report that the average member of the public could look at and say, right, here are the 50 enterprises. This one is making money. This one is losing money. But this is why we're still in it. Beyond that, we came up with something. I don't know
what were those?
It's really to do with reporting.
Yes.
And establishing, Catherine was very strong on recommending a study of the sector, an analysis, professionally organized and paid for by the state, so that we know where we stand. We need to, you know, to take a snapshot of where we are presently, so that we can go forward on the basis of information,
absolutely,
rather than guessing as to where we stand.
I would support that, some kind of a cabinet appointed working party, or a working party appointed by the parliament, but certainly an independent one with no politicians involved, possibly some analysts or researchers or policy makers, public policy scholars. And so let us get down and see what we have done, what were the stated intentions, where have we come. Thing I want to say, David, it will be remiss of me to come off the show without mentioning these two points, and when we come into the end, is that when the premier of China was here, the president of China was here in the first week of June, an agreement was signed with respect to Lake Asphalt that concerned me greatly. We had a report in the press that Lake Asphalt, which of course is a state-owned enterprise, had signed an agreement with a particular company from China to exploit the asphalt down at Labre. And at the same time, they signed a confidentiality agreement, which is as far as I'm concerned, is an attempt to thwart any kind of requests to see what is the contents of that agreement.
Yes.
So we have significant national assets that have been placed on the table and entered into a negotiation. It appears that an MOU, an agreement has been reached with the Chinese elements. But in fact, it's also been reached that we are going to be shut out. The second point I want to say to you is that public procurement legislation is very much in the air. The government is coming forward with a particular draft bill, which is woeful. It does not meet the requirements. Let me say that to the public. It does not meet the requirements. This is our official position. This is the JCC's position. We have Congress signatures on this from the Chamber of Commerce, from the manufacturers, from AmCham, from Local Content Chamber, from Phytun. We have substantial buy-in to this position. The government's draft bill does not satisfy the requirements, and they're complex and demanding requirements in terms of the transactions in public money. It's very important that we get a new system of law in place to control transactions in public money for the defense of the public interest. We've written objecting to that bill to Minister Tiwari, and of course we have proposals of our own that have been prepared in the form of a draft bill on the JCC website, but jcc.org.tt.
I'm glad you said that.
And I want to say that, in fact, one of the most detrimental parts of the government's proposed draft bill is that, in fact, it deliberately and specifically omits government-to-government arrangements, which in fact would be a real shame, because if those agreements, if that draft bill of the People's Partnership Government came into law, what it would mean is that all you want, or if you wanted to pass something through without proper oversight, all you had to do was to label it or make it come within a government-to-government arrangement. We are not accepting that. That is one of the unsatisfactory elements of the Central Tenders Board Act. We are not accepting monkey see, monkey do. We want better. We don't want the same khaki pants. We want better, and betterment means recognizing the errors of the past. We reject as unsatisfactory the existing draft bill put forward by the People's Partnership, and we are urging that our bill, which has been crafted by leading industry stakeholders, become the topic for discussion. Thank you, David.
Afra, thank you very much for participating. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. You know, time flies when you're enjoying yourself. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
News that's close to home, regional and international.
This is News.
This is News at 12 noon.
Brought to you by Amar Distributor Limited. Do.
Gordon to probe Jack's claims. Prime Minister, the DCP, and Munilal speak out on the recent killing. Two die in a car accident. Coker applies to join the ILP. And baby Destiny to be reunited with her father. This is your 12 noon major news on Moy FM 104.7. Brought to you by Amara Distributors. I'm Roxanne Gialdo.